This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Barbara Bogave. According to a new report, I'm told that you're probably not listening to this show in your car. And I mention that because researchers at the University of Michigan claim that fewer Americans are driving or even owning cars these days. Maybe that's because consumers are fed up. The Consumer Federation of America says cars are the number one thing we gripe about, according to their top 10 list of consumer complaints. And here to talk about why our autos make us so angry is Lynette Kalfani-Cox. She's an author and personal finance expert, better known as the Money Coach. Welcome back to Marketplace Money, Lynette.
Thank you, Barbara, for having me.
Okay, my first thought, you know, those of us who do drive spend so much time every day in our cars. So that's why we complain about them so much, right? What do you think about this brilliant and original theory?
Well, I think it's not only reflective of the amount of time that we spend in our cars, but the amount of money that we spend on them. So consumers feel, and I think rightfully so, cheated if something goes wrong with their car, particularly a new automobile, that they expect to be up to snuff.
Okay, well, what are the most common complaints you hear from car owners?
I mean, certainly it can range from performance issues to problems with the engine to safety-related concerns about brakes and, you know, maybe gas pedal that don't work properly, things of that nature. And I think those are serious. But even if someone's, you know, window doesn't roll up or down the way it should be, or the top on a convertible, say, is sticking or not shutting and opening properly, that's cause for concern as well.
You know, I'm sticking with my theory, Lynette. You didn't budge me. I think it's because it's so annoying to deal with these, you know, little complaints every day. But say I own a Lemon, you know, a car that's constantly in the shop. How does the Lemon Law really help me, and what legal recourse do I have?
Unfortunately, a lot of consumers aren't really aware of their rights under state Lemon Laws. State Lemon Laws are geared toward the buyers of relatively new cars who've made what most state laws call a reasonable number of attempts to get those problems fixed. And reasonable is typically defined as 3 or 4 times. Well, when the problems haven't gotten fixed to the customer's satisfaction, you actually have a number of areas where you can get recourse, financial recourse, due to having a Lemon car. One of them is that you can get a cash buyback of a Lemon car. And that's, in essence, getting back all the money that you spent on the car, your down payment, the trade-in, tax, license fees, et cetera. All of that you can get back. You can also do something that's called a swap for a new car. In essence, you exchange that Lemon vehicle you purchased for another car. And it's typically a MSRP for MSRP swap, meaning it's kind of like a trade without depreciation. And then lastly, you can also get cash compensation for whatever defect has shown to be you know, regular and recurring in the car that you purchased. So people really should look into it if they feel that a car hasn't been performing, is defective, and is giving them serious ongoing problems. Among state Lemon Laws, there's something called a fee shifting provision. And in a nutshell, it means that if you had to sue somebody, which obviously means you had to go to court, take time, and pay an attorney to represent you, then you can get your legal bills paid for, again, under the state Lemon Law. Really, you'd be suing under those scenarios the manufacturer, not the dealer. The dealership is sort of just the middleman. But you'd be suing the dealer because, in essence, you'd be saying, you know, under law, I really sort of didn't get what I paid for, which is also reflective of your rights under a federal law dealing with Lemon vehicles. And that law is called the Magnus-Moss Warranty Act. The good news about that one is that it actually also covers used cars, not just new cars, which is most applicable for state Lemon laws.
Well, Lynette, I hope you can stick around because we actually have some callers with questions about cars and questions in general about personal finance. So you ready to take some calls?
I am indeed. Let's do it.
That's great. Dean is on the line from Virginia Beach. Hello, Dean.
Hey, how are you doing?
Yeah, welcome. Good. So I see you're in the market for a new car because your daughter got her learner's permit?
Well, I'm in the market for another car. Yeah, So she got her learner's permit, and we are a one-vehicle family, and that is a large SUV. So I'd like to get something smaller for her to learn it.
Now, before we get to the car question, how are you holding up? Because I just taught my second teenager how to drive, and I have the gray hair to show for it.
It's going fairly well. There's moments where the knuckles are starting to turn a little white. But overall, it's not going too bad. But that's part of the large SUV thing.
Yeah, that's a challenge for a teenager.
Yeah, that has too much power and can be a little hard to park sometimes.
Right. Okay, so what are you looking for in a second car for your daughter? And I imagine for the rest of the family to use too, right?
Yeah. I'm just looking for a small SUV, like a four-cylinder SUV. And I'm really torn between a new and a used car because used cars seem to be rather expensive. I'm really just looking for something that's very safe and very reliable, something that's going to last me 5 or 10 years because it'll be a second car for me to use as well.
Gotcha. Okay, and you like your SUVs, it sounds like.
Well, I need something to be able to put surfboards and stand-up paddleboards on.
So oh, okay. Now we're getting somewhere. Okay.
Yeah,
I have
a
picture of what's going on in your family. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So, Lynette, what should Dean be looking for?
Well, given that he wants this car, A, for the family's use, and B, for his teenage daughter's use, I would not recommend a new car. If you're trying to save money, in essence, believe it or not, the cheapest cars overall to insure are minivans and sedans. Now, good luck trying to get your teenager to drive a minivan, so you won't want that. The sedan option actually is probably, from a financial perspective, will be your cheapest option. But I just want to highlight one other point. Because you have a teenage daughter who's just gotten her learner's permit, I assume she's probably right around 16 years old. And unfortunately for us, and I say us because I'm putting myself in that boat as well, my daughter turns 16 in 2 weeks. Unfortunately for us, the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety says that 16-year-olds are the single most dangerous set of drivers on the road. As a result, it probably will come as no surprise to you that your insurance rates are going to shoot up, likely dramatically. So it's not at all uncommon, once you add a teen driver to the mix, to see your insurance premiums go up by double, triple, or in some cases even quadruple.
Lynette, though, doesn't it help that this is a daughter we're talking about? And don't grades, also good grades, figure into the equation as well for many insurers?
They do indeed. Overall, however, even though statistically teen boys have more accidents than do teen girls, it's still the case that 16-year-olds overall and teenagers in general have obviously less experience behind the wheel and therefore higher rates of accidents. And it's everything from them, again, not having the skill set and the experience, but also things like texting and driving, unfortunately, being distracted, drivers behind the wheel of a car. The fact that she has a learner's permit, obviously, to start is a good thing because right now she'll be able to get some of that experience under her belt, and she can only drive with an adult in the car with her. So you'll be able to monitor some of her habits. But there are some ways to offset those expected rising insurance premiums you have to pay. And yes, good grades is one of them. Your daughter, if she has a 3.0 grade point average or better, typically insurers will give a discount for that, often a healthy discount, 20 to 25% or so. Whatever type of vehicle you buy, you emphasize that you wanted something safe and reliable. That's smart because safety features also lower your auto insurance premiums. So you'll want to get something with anti-lock brakes, with, you know, automatic seat belts, with airbags, things of that nature. And there's two other ways, though, that you can lower your overall cost with your teenage daughter. One is have her to take a defensive driving class. A lot of insurers will give you credit in the form of a lower, premium for that. And then also, it sounds like she's only going to be driving the car, you know, sometimes. So, and it'll be mainly for family use. So if that's the case, you can also ask about what's called a low mileage discount. Maybe, for example, she only will drive the car. I don't know if she has a job or not, but if she only has, say, a weekend job, and maybe she drives the car to and from work, then her time behind the wheel will be limited. So you might be able to get a low mileage discount as well.
Dean, does that help you out? That was a load of info.
No, that does. And she is a very good student. And she's not concerned with speed right now. So
she's great.
Into the utility. So I think she's on my side with this.
Well, good luck to you and safe driving for you and your daughter.
Great. Thank you very much.
Lynette Kalfani-Cox is with us today, answering your questions about money. And earlier in the show, we heard about potential changes coming to the mortgage business. But the inevitability of higher mortgage rates isn't stopping some folks from going on a house hunt. Amy in San Diego is one of them. She hopes to be a homeowner soon, but she's a little stumped by the process, and she's on the line now. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Lynette and Barbara.
Hello there.
Hi, Amy.
Hi.
So what do you do there in San Diego?
I am a Chinese language teacher.
Oh, you teach Mandarin?
I do.
Okay. Ni hao? Is that
right? Well, hi, hao. Good job. Good job.
I've exhausted my Mandarin. What made you want to jump in and buy a home? Tell us.
Well, I've been wanting to for quite a while. I moved back to the country, back to the U.S. from China about a year or so ago, and I was a little upset that I missed the really good time to buy a house in the U.S., so I feel like I want to get into the market before before the rates go back up, especially in San Diego, because it's kind of a hot market and inventory is really limited right now.
Yeah, and tricky. So do you have a specific question for Lynette?
I do. Yeah, Lynette, so my boyfriend and I are trying to find our dream house. And we've already started the process a little bit, and we've gone to a mortgage broker. But that's only because my friend also went to a mortgage broker, and he had a good experience with that. But I'm just wondering if we should go directly to a bank or look at other options for our loan instead of to a mortgage broker.
Well, there are pros and cons to using a mortgage broker to help you secure a mortgage. The biggest advantage is that a broker can shop around in the marketplace for you and can field any number of potential mortgage products from a variety of lenders. If you go direct to a bank, they're obviously going to try to sell you essentially on their particular loan products. So the broker widens the scope and the field of possibilities for you.
But Lynette, now, Amy has to do her homework too, right? And not just trust the broker?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I'm assuming that she's worried about having to pay the broker certain fees that
I'm wondering about those fees.
In all honesty, the fees can be slapped on at any point in the process if you go direct to a bank or if you use a broker. And in a lot of cases, they'll say the word fee at the end to sort of signal that this is just some almost optional kind of fee that they've, slapped on or tacked onto the process, an application fee, a loan processing fee, an underwriting fee, a mortgage review fee, things of that nature. Those are the things that you should look out for, regardless of whether or not you're going direct to a bank or using a broker. There's some fees, of course, that you're just not going to get around because this is part of the business of them making loans and you obtaining a mortgage. And so you'll have certain legal fees, you'll have title fees, you'll have insurance fees, transfer taxes. But I think the overall thing that I would emphasize is that you should get your disclosures up front. Initially, when you apply for a mortgage, a lender is supposed to give you a good faith estimate. And so they should give you that GFE, as it's called, to tell you very clearly, here are the fees that we expect you to incur in this mortgage. And then you can take one or two or three even and comparison shop among different lenders or even among different brokers and see where the fees all stack up. On the back end, once a loan is closed, you'll get something called a HUD-1 statement. And you should do a very close comparison and look at what they told you up front in terms of the good faith estimate versus what's finalized on the back end with your HUD one statement and reconcile the two. I mean, there can be some little, you know, charges that are slightly above perhaps what was quoted or within a range, but you shouldn't see all new fees introduced on the HUD one statement,
okay,
or you shouldn't see a doubling of fees, things of that nature.
And Lynette, just quickly, do you have any advice on finding a responsible broker? Because I've bought houses, my experience buying houses with and without brokers is that in a very difficult legal climate, which we're in now in buying a house, that some brokers, they just know so much more. I mean, it's as if you have a lawyer in your pocket helping you buy the house.
Right. I think referrals are one good source of information, certainly. And I think that you mentioned that you had a friend, Amy, who did, in fact, refer you to a broker. A lot of times having a trusted relative, friend, a colleague, someone that you know who's actually used a given person's services and having them sort of vouch for it is one of the strongest recommendations that you could possibly get. I, too, have used both a broker, a mortgage broker, and have gone direct to banks. And frankly, I was satisfied in both cases. So I think it's a matter of personal preference. Some people go directly to the bank that they're currently doing business with. And I would sort of caution you against that as just sort of default position. Some people think if they, whether or not they're making a new purchase or even a refinance for an existing mortgage, they'll just automatically go to, you know, XYZ Bank if they have a checking account or savings or if they do some other business there. I think you should broaden your horizons, though, and not automatically make the assumption that an existing bank or mortgage company is going to always give you the best deal. You really do need to shop around.
Okay.
Amy, I hope that helps you out.
All right. Yeah, it really does. Thank you so much.
Great. Good luck on your house hunt. Thanks so much for reaching out to Marketplace Money. And all of you listening, you can get in touch with us, too, with your questions. You can ask us about student loans or home loans or car loans or whatever's on your mind. Just write to us at marketplacemoney.org. Lynette, it was great having you with us.
Thank you so much, Barbara. I'll have to come back on soon.
Oh, I hope so. It was lovely. Lynette Kalfani-Cox is a personal finance expert. You can find a link to her site, askthemoneycoach.com, at our show page, marketplacemoney.org. And thanks again, Lynette. It was such a pleasure.
Thank you, Barbara.